Welcome to the Two World Podcast, where you can hear thoughts and reflections on unique intersections between faith and culture. Tune in regularly for this foray into feelings of surprise and interconnectedness and aha moments in life when two worlds come together. Now join your hosts, Barney and Jacob, for this most recent episode.
Everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Two World Podcast. I will be getting us started off today, and I am Barney. And my co-host today, he is joining me, and he is
Jacob.
And today we have an interesting topic. As I was thinking about the topic that we're discussing today, I thought, if we did more production with this podcast, we could have the theme from 2001 playing, you know, to maybe accompany the beginning of this. And I know it has a specific name, and I'm scolding myself for not thinking it up. We're looking it up, because I know that referencing our live music episode, that Fish does a really good rendition of that theme.
Can we hum it? Is that okay?
Oh, yeah, okay.
Which one of us wants to do the drums, and which one wants to do the instruments?
You start with the drum, and I'll do the drum.
Okay, so you do the build up then.
Boom, 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 boom. The first for us.
Nice.
Yeah, and then I panicked that maybe I was getting off tune, so you'll have to forgive me if that's true. So all of this to say that Jacob proposed a really interesting topic of looking at, especially in the different contexts of where we're living, and even our jobs, how has AI kind of been playing a role in where we are, how we see it developing in our different contexts, and maybe how it might even impact, or maybe is impacting, our professions, or maybe those of people that we know, or that we see and observe in our daily lives. And I'd like to start off with you, Jacob, and just kind of one thing that we do sometimes is let's hear the background, the impetus, everything that went into coming up with this topic today.
Absolutely. Thanks for asking, Barney. And thanks for being willing to jump into this with me. So for me, I really am fascinated by technology and like to use software and tools to help me when I'm working or thinking about things and preparing for things. And the first time that I really heard about AI as something you could use as a tool was when they came, I'm trying to think of the name, is OpenAI is behind ChatGPT. Well, they announced, I saw it on Google News, this story, you know, that there were beta testers starting to use it, and you could sign up to be a tester. You could join a wait list, and, you know, and then as they enroll it, they will give more and more access to people. And I was just curious because, as we had mentioned before starting our podcast, you know, AI has been around for quite a while in science fiction, and often to the peril of humans. You know, if you think about the series like Terminator or others, such, you know, dystopian science fiction stories, the AI in those stories takes over and ultimately enslaves humanity in a way, or wants to do away with humanity. And so, you know, I think there's this human fascination with, like, what can we do? How much can we create? But also a fear of, like, could we create something so bad that it could eventually threaten us? And we have definitely seen that in human history with like nuclear technology when it's used in weaponry. But anyway, I signed up for ChatGPT, and then I got early access, or I was among that first wave of people on that sign up list, and started playing around with it. And I was just so surprised with how adept it was at responding to general conversational queries. And so, you know, I wanted to test it out in terms of its ability to respond to theological questions, you know, being a person who serves the ministry, I'm like, how would it handle something like this? And I couldn't believe how balanced its answers were. And sometimes I would ask questions that had some historical components, you know, related to the theology I was asking about. Like, we've talked before in previous episodes about how I've done some research in the area of the theology of spiritual gifts. And so I was asking it different questions related to that. And it was coming up with pretty good answers. Not, I wouldn't say necessarily rivaling like the best scholarship you can find, but pretty good standard general answers, you know? And so that surprised me. So I thought, wow, how could this type of tool be used in preparing for talks or presentations, you know, to synthesize information? And what I really wanted to do is I have a lot of resources that in digital form already, and I wanted to use the tool as a way to take a large amount of the resources I already have and quickly work through them, synthesize material, compare and contrast. And so that's pretty much how I've been using it since then. I basically, when I'm getting ready for a message or to teach or give a presentation, when I'm doing my preparation, I'll consult my tools. And then sometimes I will take some of the information and I'll plug it into either ChatGPT, or I also really like Anthropic's AI client tool called Claude. I think that one's really interesting. And I'll ask questions about, you know, the information I have and the resources, sometimes to pinpoint certain aspects of it or relate it to a certain question that I'm asking that I've thought about, but I'd like to have a different angle on. And so most recently I did a little bit of a test case with this, and I was telling you about it before our episode. I had been studying this passage in Hebrew with my friend Cody from Genesis chapter 1, and the word for heavens came up in our study, and he was asking me questions about it. And I thought, oh, I want to do a deeper dive into that. So I read, I have a number of resources that can unpack the meaning of Hebrew words. And so I read through all of them first on my own and looked through them. And I was drawing my own conclusions because, you know, sometimes there's quite a bit of overlap between resources, but then sometimes you get different conclusions and, you know, disparity. And so I thought, I'm going to enter every single one of these lexical entries into Claude, and I'm going to ask it, you know, to compare and contrast them and then rank them in terms of their usefulness for a broader understanding of the Hebrew word for heaven or heavens, which is Shemaim. And I did. And I was so shocked because it went through all those resources and it ranked them almost exactly how I would have based on my years of using them, just based on this one entry. It said to me that these large language learning models have been trained well enough that they can discern content and material that's specific to a discipline, as well as sometimes somebody who's had a fair amount of training in that discipline. I wouldn't necessarily say I put them on the level of an expert, but I mean, I was just really surprised by that. So that kind of sets me, as a tool, it's quite powerful. I think you have to know what the query should be and how to use it best, and also be aware that it has limits. And sometimes certain AI tools have been known to hallucinate information, you know, put things, you know, draw conclusions that aren't there. Which I have a funny story I want to share about that later, but I need to stop talking because I've been going on so long. But that is both the reason why I wanted to talk about it and how I've been using it a little bit. But let me turn it to you now and get your thoughts. When you heard that I was interested in this, what were you thinking? And then maybe you could give a little bit of background to our audience about how you've been working with it, if you have.
Yeah, it kind of made me think of kind of a point that you touched on, that it's been around in some form or another for a while in a way. Like one thought that came to mind is like when you had programs that you could enter text and it would read it to you, you know, that in a way that's like at the really very beginning of using a tool that we didn't, using computers in a way that maybe we didn't think that they would be able to do it, you know, to like just think, wow, this computer program can read this to me, you know, that's something that I never would have guessed that could be possible a few years ago. And I remember in my first year of university, even, and I don't remember how I came upon this resource, but I found online someone who was researching language, and he had his own program that he developed called Jabberwacky, you know, kind of related to the Lewis Carroll character, the Jabberwocky. And it was supposed to be able to chat with you. You know, like you could ask it questions and it would give you responses. And sometimes they were passable, but more often than not, they really didn't quite make sense with your answer. It was, you could tell that it had a ways to go. But and I tried to find that resource again, and I think it has since been taken down. But you know, people had been thinking about how can there be a way to communicate in a sensible way with artificial intelligence. And here, you know, obviously it's been really sustained effort, and here we're coming up with a lot of new things that are workable in a way, and like you said, are passable in to some degree. And when we thought about, as I've been thinking about this for the past weeks, and you know, especially thinking about some of the maybe potential downsides to it, you know, like hearing how students you really clued into this and realized it could help them quickly get their homework done in a way to put it you know, in a way there. But then that really opens up the question. Then one question I've been thinking of, and we'll probably get into this topic a little bit deeper, is, you know, it's a huge pain to write research papers. It's a huge, huge pain. I've done the research. Is it so bad if I enter my data and ask, you know, and then let's say that I use an analysis tool, you know, to look at the data in the right way using the right formula that I want to use. And so I do all the work except for the writing. Is that so bad that I ask AI to, you know, the research is mine, the program, you know, the whole project is mine, just, you know, slogging through pages and pages of, you know, what ends up being kind of like rote in a way, you know. Everyone kind of writes the same way, you know, everyone kind of writes the same things, everyone kind of does this, you know. It's not until you get into describing your research project and then analyzing the data and seeing how that's relevant that you get to something new. So, you know, couldn't I just ask AI to write the first half of my paper for me? And I wonder, you know, because of course a lot of people would say, no, you know, you've got to do it yourself. But then a lot of people would also probably say, like me, you know, well, what's the harm in just getting through the first part, you know, to the, you know, through kind of the window dressing until you get to the real heart of what the research project is about. And I don't know.
Yeah, I would love to talk about that, Barney, because I think both of us, I think we can approach this from a couple of lenses. And one is having both gone through graduate school, where like there is an emphasis on originality of your research and academic rigor and doing your own work and citing all of your sources, and in particular, not taking credit for things that aren't your own. I think there has to be a way to uphold academic integrity like that. If you want to use the AI tool, there has to be a way to uphold that while at the same time using the tool in a way that benefits you but doesn't replace the originality and the academic rigor. And so what I'm thinking is, like, so for the example you gave, if somebody has a lot of data, I think it might be helpful to, like, you know, do some reflection, do their own work with it, But then, you know, a good use of the AI tool might be, you know, to kind of check your work or to say, or to see if there's things you missed, connections you missed in the data, because AI is able to take such a large amount of data. And if you, you can apply very specific parameters in the questions you ask it, and it can crunch the data and can see a bigger picture sometimes that we might miss certain things. So I think if you do your own work and then you use this model is another complement to that, to help you see maybe some things you've seen. And then I think the academic community is probably going to get better and better about how to name or recognize when AI is used. For example, I don't know, I saw a commercial recently for Grammarly. And, you know, Grammarly is this writing assistant tool that up to this point has been kind of like a souped up version of like Microsoft Word's spell checker, you know, but now that it has the power of these large language learning models integrated in, it can, you know, give larger, more powerful suggestions about the grammar and the structure of your writing. So I noticed in the commercial, it said, and, you know, use Grammarly to help you write even better, and then acknowledge it, when you cite your sources or something, and it had this, and the person had a button and it showed like a history of how they used Grammarly for their paper. And then I spoke with an English teacher who is in a Catholic high school in Cleveland. And I was asking him about like his approach with his students. And he said, if they can show how they use the tool in the process of their writing, not as a replacement for their own thinking and their own writing, but to show like if it helped them think or frame certain questions, or how would it stimulating to them to get the ball rolling in certain areas, you know, maybe just kind of even a general question to get them thinking in a certain area. Can you generate a question for me about, you know, Ella Fitzgerald's use of, you know, you could plug in to get them thinking, but if they use it in the process to help the reflection, it's an aid. But if they just want to plug in a, something and quickly spit out and copy and paste, obviously that's ethically how do I want to say it, misguided, and it's not doing the work, and it's essentially akin, it's like akin to plagiarism in a way. I mean, even though the AI that's generating the text isn't a published author as such of it, but so I don't know, those are my thoughts. Like, I think there's a place for it as a tool, as a complement to what you have, but it should never be like wholesale, you know, just copied and pasted for sure. It should only be used as a tool to help stimulate and come alongside. And your point too about, well, what about just getting started? Yeah, I think it could help somebody in terms of some reflection questions or get them ball rolling in their mind of, you know, how to tackle something, but shouldn't be a replacement. So what are your thoughts about it?
Yeah, I loved your idea, your suggestion, especially about looking at data that, or looking at the whole project. You know, it might be that AI said, well, you know, you could use it as a tool. Again, what I've been thinking about, you know, kind of a devil's advocate thing, and thinking, you know, what if it's very possible that it said, you know, it would be, you know, before you start the research project, you know, it would come up with suggestions of probably ways to approach the project in the first place, and might be different from what you were thinking. And then when it comes to looking at data, there are so many different methods of analyzing data. And the hardest part is understanding which method you need to use. And again, like, the AI would probably recommend, you know, what about looking at it using this method or this method? You know, there's so many different ways to chart it or graph it or whatnot, and it would probably come up with a way to help you see it in a different way, and maybe see connections that you weren't necessarily looking at. But then you would have to double check with you know, like, kind of the standard recognized data analysis tools that that researchers are supposed to be using to confirm whether or not that you know, that significance or correlation actually exists. One kind of interesting thought that I had would be, and I don't know if you should necessarily do this, but thinking about AI and its uses from your point of view, I wonder what it would be like if you asked, AI, you know, it would to like come up with like a call to worship, or like, you know, like a 15-minute sermon, and then just read that word for word. and then see how it is received by people, if it is actually inspirational, or if like it's kind of obvious that this wasn't really written by a person, or if it's you know actually very passable and like something that's very thought-provoking. Because I think of the many fields where like you really couldn't replace a person, it seems like something dealing with faith is, and especially someone like a pastor, would be almost impossible to replace that job with using AI with, I would think.
Barney, that's a really great question. And I have explored AI as a tool, like when I'm getting ready for sermons, certain sections, like as I'm thinking about it, I'll ask questions that help me reflect on the topic to the AI and get, or I'll do, like I said before, like I'll have my own reflection and I want to compare it to see like what the AI's analysis of the passage or a word will be. But I don't feel like it would work super well to just try to tell the AI, like, write me a sermon about such and such, because I feel like, first off, the AI tends to have a very condensed form of output that is, like, it's very concise, and it is readable as like a dictionary entry, you know, but it as a sermon, it might be, it would adapt its style for sure, because AI and language models are trained on, I'm sure, sermon texts are in their database, so they can emulate. But I think what it would generate would probably be like short and concise, and wouldn't be fleshed out, and would be very generic. And so part of the task of like a minister or a pastor or somebody who's teaching in a community is to relate the passage to the unique needs and situation that's in their community and in their congregation. So I don't think, unless if the AI was given a lot of parameters, it would even know in like how to zero in on those. And even if it were given the parameters, it would feel somewhat impersonal. So I think the AI, just like that English teacher said, it could be used in the preparation process, I think, by somebody writing a message to say, you know, is there reviewing material and trying to think of a way to, you know, explore certain ideas and combined ideas, and like the AI could stimulate the thinking. And then I think after they've done that work and reflected, they try to adapt that into their own language and into their context for their community. It would be helpful. Now, interestingly enough, for a call to worship, which is a much more focused statement, you can, I have used AI before just to see like, what could a sample of call to worship be related to the theme of Pentecost, for example, you know, and as it relates to this passage, like you could give it some parameters, and sometimes it'll give some words, or it'll give a call to worship that's formulaic, and you can tweak that. But I would say like, that's another case where it was good for the writing process. Like you could see a sample of what one looks like, but then I would think it would be helpful to like personalize it, make it related to like the local community and the language that, you know, makes sense and resonates with the people there. So I think as a tool in the writing process, it can be helpful. It can give you examples, some ideas as you're thinking about. But I do know, and I had heard that there was one worship service maybe several months ago where everything in the service was generated by AI. It was like an experiment. Yeah. Did you hear about that? So, I mean, it can be done, but I kind of feel like what you said earlier is very helpful. It's like it's meaningful to have a human being with the creativity and the calling, the sense of commitment to the local community to try to work on these things instead of, you know, just having them generated for us. It feels like that to me does not a good use of the tool. It would be more as a help is what I would see it. You know? And the same could probably be said for artists and authors and any creative enterprise and writers. Like you could generate, there are books for sale on Amazon that are AI generated books, but like, why are we trying to replace the artistic enterprises. Like, that's one area of human life and existence that is seems kind of uniquely matched with the human spirit. Like we were saying last week in the episode about burning down the house, you know, with Northern Exposure, like that something within the human soul and the spirit yearns to express itself in art, and AI can create artistic expression, but it doesn't seem like the most pertinent use of that tool. And one of my friends, Mark Suter, who has a podcast that he does on Star Wars called Tarkin's Top Shelf, just a shout out to him in his podcast. But we were talking about this past week, and that was his main point, because he's an author. And he said, why would we as a society want AI to start generating this content? We have all these artists, authors willing to do it, and it's stirred up to do that and caring about it. So I feel like that is a little bit of a quandary or an ethical dilemma, like to not surrender that part of our society, to just say, oh, you know, machines can generate this. And I don't even know, and I wouldn't even say that what is generated at this point would rival, you know, obviously, what the humans creating. I mean some AI art is incredible, and it's amazing what can be done with it, but I wouldn't say in the totality, oh, it can just be substitute for human art. But what do you think about that, Barney?
Yeah, I think that especially thinking in terms of stories and writing in that way, that there's something about the imagination and about, like you say, the stirring, and like when an author gets an idea of a story and just is so dedicated and devoted to get it started and get it going. And then I think about the books that I've read and that I'm reading, and how they draw you in and how you can imagine it yourself. And you can sense that the author was imagining something similar when that person was writing the story as well. And yeah, I've never read in a book written by AI, but I imagine it probably wouldn't be so captivating, or it would probably just end up reading like one of those books that, you know, like you just see, like that are, you know, just mass produced and just out there for a book to be out there, not as any kind of something to grip you and, you know, move you and have you reflect on the world around you, on yourself, thanks to that book. And probably the same way that it would go with visual art too. Thinking of this and thinking back to to actually another podcast, a radio show, This American Life, I heard one of my favorite episodes was when they use numbers in the way that they shouldn't be used. And there were two researchers who collected, they did two different ways. Their first research project was to survey numerous people on what kind of art that they liked from different countries. And then they produced some art, visual art, based on survey responses. And then later they researched people, you know, they surveyed people, all these people, what kind of music do they like? What are the topics? What's the length? What kind of, what kind of instruments, what kind of singers do you like? And they went and they produced two songs. They produced the most popular song, and then they produced the least popular song. And the most popular song, you know, it's like 3 minutes, 21 seconds, you know, it has like soft, saxophone, and it has like, you know, like kind of R&B sound to it, you know, and it's about relationships, and it's just, you know, passable. It's like a song that you've heard millions of times. And then the least popular song, it's like 21 minutes long. It has cowboy music, it has opera, it has songs about holidays, it has jingles in it. And there's something about it that is so interesting. and that, in that way, is taking something that, you know, it shouldn't be done. You know, we shouldn't try to quantify and then produce music that way, or, you know, either through research or through AI, and then flipping it on its end, on its end there, and going exactly the opposite. And it created something artistic in that way. So You know, if we would kind of an illustration, if we would just let AI come up with our music and our books and our art, we would end up something that we've all seen however many times. And yeah, it's interesting, but it's forgettable. But then if we allow humans to take that and come up with their creativity, then we come up with this wild song and other things like that. And yeah, I think that's something that just can't be replaced in these kind of elements like art and whatnot. That,
that's a really good point. And maybe just for a moment, if we could relate this, specifically thinking about artists, to the idea that there is some kind of ethical commitment to the source and the creativity of each artist. That's why we have our copyright system. And the fact that AI through machine learning has been trained on thousands and millions and however many incredibly large amounts of texts and images of, in many cases, works that, you know, the artists themselves may or may not have known what were even being scanned and analyzed. You know, and then when the AI renders its own amalgamation of, from all these different things of artistic expression, you know, some of that, some portion of that could be taken from, you know, the inspiration of specific artists. And what does that mean? I know a group of artists I had read recently were suing some of the AI companies because their books had been scanned in without them knowing, you know. And so if part of this language learning model was trained on their content, and when a query or something is asked of it that to produce something, it could generate some portion of their work, you know, what is the ethical responsibility of the company? I know I'm taking this in a different way maybe than you were just a moment ago, but I kind of wondered if you had any thought about maybe the peril of that, the challenge of that, you know, as it relates to this idea of the realm of creativity and art and safeguarding the artist from plagiarism. Or
and actually to reference our last podcast again, you know, where Chris made that wonderful point, you know, repetition is the death of art. And you know, if AI comes up with some painting or something or some story that, wow, this looks like it could be a Monet or something, but then, you know, there's something lost in it because there's not that same force that was behind what Monet really painted or what Shakespeare really wrote. You know, I think that is the one element that just can't be reproduced, and there's that captivity, the captivation that comes with it. And I think also to reference another podcast that we had with Chris Matsos, that catharsis, you know, that comes from something being produced on the stage, you know, or some the reason why we go see movies, you know, the reason why we listen to live music, you know, the reason why, you know, we have favorite authors. Even there's something that the human soul, that something in our heart really connects with this and keeps drawing us back to that. And if it's just something that's mass produced, then there's just something that's going to be lost. But yeah, then how would you feel? I can just really understand how those authors are feeling if, you know, it probably made them feel like it cheapened their work to have it just scanned and then reproduced in part or in whole or kind of slightly altered. And then people who didn't know the original work read this and they think, oh, whoa, hey, wow, that's really amazing. This AR is really fantastic. Not knowing that it was based on, you know, what someone else had actually written from, you know, deep within, you know, their struggle to get that put out. And,
yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
But I was wondering if maybe, you know, talking about art and talking about whatnot, you know, I think we have a little interesting image that we could probably look at, especially for those of you watching on YouTube. Jacob, why don't you introduce what we're about to look at?
Yes. So before recording, Barney and I thought it would be interesting to use Microsoft's Bing image generator to create several sample logos for what a podcast on AI could look like. And so it generated four images for us, and here they are on the screen. And, you know, it's interesting. If I were to create a logo about AI, I don't know that I would have thought of either of these. Oh, I mean, yeah. It seems like a number of them are trying to give the imagery of a brain tissue between headphones. Do you sense that?
Yeah.
Like, well, neural network slash, like in some cases, it looks like the brain tissue, the way it's curvature. And so I guess I wouldn't have thought of that. I don't know what I would have thought of, but it's different than I would have expected. What are your thoughts, Barney?
Yeah, I completely agree. And I wonder if you feel the same way, that at least three of these kind of have like kind of a sinister motif, theme to them. Like the very first one, the top left with the dark background, and then kind of modeled after a brain with like two eyes.
Yes.
And it really does not look happy.
It does not.
And then the one right to it had the colors are cheerful, but I look at the left and there's kind of like a blue dot inside, again, what looks like it could be eyes. And that gives it that, plus kind of the harder lines that are slanted, also gives it a sinister look. And then the bottom left one, that one just makes me think of Dracula in a way.
Looks
really spooky, to be honest. It again looks like it could be maybe like half neural network, like you're saying, and then half person,
like
or
a cyborg.
Robot. Yeah, or cyborg is a good way. Yes. Yeah, right. Yeah, and then it has a lot of red in it, and that's probably where my brain was coming up with the Dracula part. And then the final one, I think, is supposed to meant to kind of look nice and happy, but it again really plays on the theme of a brain, and they all have like a metallic feel to them, I guess, kind of the machinery part to it. And so none of them are exactly, in my opinion, none of them are so appealing, and definitely none of them are so soothing to look at. Yeah,
I agree, Barney. I feel like, I don't know if it feels like an exaggeration to say that they're kind of vapid or like soulless, but like there's something to the art that it was a response to a query. So you can see how this was generated based on what you said, but it doesn't seem, there's not a warmth or it doesn't feel inspiring.
Right.
I like to use pictures and images in sermons. And I entered some queries before in to wonder if some AI image would, you know, be like a good alternative to a picture. And I just really struggle to find any that ever feel like a fit. And it's fascinating to me, you know, if this is just an object lesson here, if this is how we feel about this imagery, you could probably push that out and say similar things about text, you know, or AI generated music, or AI generated, if there are, you know, is film or video, like you could feel a sense of like, it feels like it's different or lacking that some of the warmth or the, I guess, I don't know if you say humanity of the artists, I'm not sure, but it reminds me of this podcast that Katie was listening to a while back. And I think it was a podcast with maybe a sociologist or a psychologist, and she had taken her daughter to a zoo. But there was this one area where they had an electronic turtle. And like, it was kind of odd because, you know, there were live animals elsewhere, and her daughter seemed really into it. And she went up to her daughter and she's like, or maybe she debriefed with her afterwards. And she's like, you know, that turtle wasn't real, right? Is what she said to her daughter. And she's like, I know, I didn't care. It was still really cool to see. And she kind of really, after talking with her daughter more about it, just got the impression that it didn't bother her daughter that it wasn't a real turtle. She just enjoyed looking at it all the same. But for her, like the parent, she wasn't interested in it because it was like robotic. And so like, I wonder if that sentiment could be applied to AI art and AI literature and whatever else It's just, if somebody knows that it was generated by AI and they know that there's not another human on the other side of that with their aspirations and yearnings and dreams and wishes, like, would it change their experience? And I think it would for a lot of people. And some people might say they don't care. But I think a lot of people would be like, well, if there's no other human on the other end of that, like, I'm not interested in looking at it because it's not real. You know, so I guess that's the question is, what constitutes what is real and what is not real in terms of, you know, art we look at or literature, things that we seek to read. And so I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, it would make me curious about that worship service that you mentioned. If the people knew ahead of time that it would all be done, you know, everything that would be read, you know, and whatnot in the service was by AI, I think a lot of people would respond that, oh, well, that wasn't fulfilling. But and then, of course, you really wouldn't want in something like church, you wouldn't want to deceive people, you know, in order to get their honest reaction to, you know, not being, you know, not knowing ahead of time, you know, to change their thinking of what they're going to get into. It would almost be like you have to have two whole worship services. And I think it also gets that interesting illustration from the story. We have a small child and we have an adult, and it shows how much with experiences in life that are interpreted by the experiences that we have had before. You know, why it's paintings that we see that we connect with, stories, you know, movies that really touch us, you know, things, those touch us because of they resonate with our experience with what we've been through in our lives. And as adults, we've collected so many more experiences, you know, probably that mom has played with a real turtle or seen a real turtle or had some real, you know, turtle experience honestly, I would probably be the same way to react like, well, what is the nice thing about this, you know? But for the daughter seeing it through such a less experienced lens, you know, it's just cool. Look at this. It's just cool, you know, and I don't mind. It's just cool, you know? So it will be interesting to see as we look at people who are growing up with AI as a bigger and bigger and bigger part of their lives, how they feel as they get older and accumulate more experiences where AI has been kind of in the background, at least at the beginning, maybe more so as they get older. I know for one thing, the news on the kind of, I guess, like public TV station, you know, it's TV here in Japan is much, much different than America. Almost nobody has cable TV. So standard TV is basically just 9 channels. And we are very, very, very much expected. There are a few gray areas, but expected to pay for one of the channel, kind of like what would be the equivalent of the public broadcasting channel. But you know, that's supported by people who willingly make donations. We rationalize it to make ourselves feel better for kind of having to pay for this. But the news that they have every morning, there's one segment always that it's just, you know, video footage, but it's read by the AI. It's not, we don't see them. We don't see the AI or whatnot. You know, we don't see the newscasters doing whatever they're doing. We just see the images and we hear the AI reading the news for us. And they have a male voice and they have a male-ish voice and a female-ish voice that read. And yeah, I'm sure that it sounds, I didn't know until my wife told me that that's what's going on. I couldn't really spot the difference because the intonation is just right. And according to the Japanese language and, you know, it sounds like what you would think someone reading the news would say, how they would speak it. And that makes sense because the news is pretty serious and you don't have to have a lot of different inflection, you know, to create a lot of different emotions. You're just delivering what happened. And it's a start. And how will things go for my kids when, especially here in Japan, with the population size changing and not necessarily immigration, whatnot, programs and efforts adjusting to keep up with the decline in population. So I think that we'll have a lot of more things that are done by AI or run by AI or however. How will my kids or their kids respond, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 years, 60 years from now? And when they see, you know, art done by people, or when they see art or movies done by, you know, their good friend AI, you know, how, or mechanical turtles, or, you know, like some, you know, mechanical woolly mammoths, you know, how will it impact them as it might impact someone like us here and now? Would be interesting to somehow, if possible, observe and talk about.
That's a really good point, Barney. Expectations and experience, and how a younger generation that grew up with the technology already there versus those of us who remember a time when it didn't exist or was much different. Yeah, that's a really good point. Well, I was fascinated thinking about this topic, and specifically your context in Japan, because for years, you know, it seems like Japan has had a kind of a pretty cutting edge industry related to robots and just technology in general, you know, being innovative and using almost like, have you seen stories about like robot pets or, you know, different that using it as a tool to help humans improve their quality of life. And so I wondered, you know, if you sense that the narrative or the general conversation around AI in Japan might be a little different or further along than it is here in the States. I don't know if you would sense that.
Yeah, I really have to wonder. I think that it probably is so. And like you say, that I think like it's a lot of adapting based on the situation that we're in. You know, it's an island country, and you know, and it's not a big one, and has aging population. It has people that are very, very, very busy. And so on the one hand, you know, it's hard to go visit your grandparents, maybe, on the one hand. And so if they can have this kind of companion animal that doesn't require so much care, you know, you don't have to feed it, you don't have to take it on a walk, you don't have to clean up after it, then yeah, that really helps serve a purpose in a way. And I think maybe you have seen articles. I think I even saw something on CNN maybe about like these mechanical wolves that are like scaring away bears, I think, and like they have like these really scary red eyes. But again, it's in response to like a situation where more and more people are moving away from these smaller villages into cities. And then so there are less people around to kind of keep the wolves, the bears, you know, more toward the forest, and then the bears, probably their habitat is changing too. And then so they have a need to kind of go in into an area where it's easier for them to find what they need. And yeah, kind of, so then we find these kind of, I wonder if they're pretty unique, maybe based on compared with other nations, you know, these other contexts, these kind of unique situations, these unique problems that come up. And the easiest or the best, I don't know the best, maybe the easiest or maybe people's first thought is, how can we have maybe a machine or something kind of help, at least help us to address this need that we've found arising, just because it's hard to, you know, we at this moment right now, we aren't able to address it how we had been, you know, with people. And I think that they find that in a way that, I think people are more familiar with robots, because like you say, there's been kind of a cutting edge sense with technology, and people are, you know, I mean, what, like all of the Gundam comic books and mangas, the and anime, the cartoons where you see lots. That's really, Japan has lots and lots and lots of robots in some of its literature and some of its, you know, movies and whatnot. And I think maybe that's why maybe people are more readily happy to. I think part of it is they see this kind of technological advancement. You know, wow, I can clap my hands and this robot dog like sits up, you know, or it recognizes my voice, you know, and I think that's neat. And then if it can also in that way serve a positive purpose of companionship in a way, then yeah, that's really neat too. And I think that from a number of different aspects and reasons and influences, that maybe it is going ahead further or at a faster pace here in Japan than other places.
That's really interesting, Barney. And that makes me think a little bit about the question of how will AI impact society more broadly. There is the kind of optimistic look that you might find in like a sci-fi series like Star Trek, for example, where in the future, due to the technology and advancement in human society, that inequality is done away with. And, you know, that there's all of this opportunity to not only sustain life on Earth, but so much so then that people look out to the stars and are seeking to make, you know, contact with other civilizations. And very optimistic view, like you can generate any type of food you want just by asking the computer, and you can travel, you know, from this place to another almost instantaneously with technology. So it's a very optimistic, I feel, view. And then, like we already referenced before, the kind of dystopian take that's, you know, in the Terminator movies. So I guess I'm kind of wondering, you know, for your own outlook, what do you think the future is? I mean, I know these things are big questions. It's hard to, you know, really guess or to know in any sense, but what is your own take? Are you more optimistic about the promise of AI and how it will impact society? Are you more guarded? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I wonder if maybe I'm even being, I don't know, naive or maybe not as well as informed as I should be, but I keep finding myself fascinated that AI can do all these things, and and there's so much that I wasn't aware of that it could do. But I always have this. I don't think that I lean toward the dystopian side at all. I always kind of have this notion that I don't know why, maybe I'm being naive still, but thinking, well, how could it get out of control? You know, how could things go that badly? How could there be like no way to you know, how could AI become so powerful that it can do these things? You know, I don't know. But at the moment, it does, you know, I see a lot of people here who maybe their job has been reduced or, you know, augmented by AI. And I do have the nagging, you know, kind of notion, you know, thought in the back of my mind, you know, maybe it's a little selfish, but thinking, oh, thankfully I'm a language teacher for kids, you know, because that's something that AI could never replace. But I always think, you know, what about other people who, you know, AI is kind of taking their job because it's easier for the robot to do it and faster. And that really, since we're at a place right now where we all remember how things used to be, and we, you know, people who are older, but still working, you know, they went to school for a certain job, and it's, you know, hard to make such an adjustment now that technology is changing, you know, and we're not sure it's new, and we're not sure what to do with it, how to integrate it so well. And then, you know, people might be worried about their position in the workforce and how they're going to, keep their paycheck making, in their lifestyle. That also nags at me on the one hand. And hopefully, like we were talking about earlier, that it's people see it as a tool to generate ideas, but then in the end, allow for and have the humans be the ones who are in charge of creating and producing the final product, and not thinking, here's my big chance to, look at the bottom line, and save all this money by just having a robot do it instead of people who have been dedicated to this company all these years. Hopefully that is the thinking that wins out. But I don't know, how do you see things shaping up yourself?
Well, it's interesting because so far there is a little bit of an economic disparity with availability of AI. For example, if you use ChatGPT or Anthropic's Claude AI system, the free versions have many more limitations than the paid versions. So it's just fascinating that they're very powerful tools, even the free versions. I know for Claude, you get so many queries before it tells you need to take a break and you won't have access again for, like, I don't know if it's 4 or 5 hours, something like that. So in terms of disparity and economic disparity and opportunity, even right now, these companies are trying to monetize these systems, like any product that a company makes. So I think it's complicated, and that's maybe where government regulations comes in, and what governments should consider about the use of AI and privacy and accountability. And I think if we have, like we have done with other things, like in efforts to curb, the proliferation of nuclear weapons with the non-proliferation treaty, or, if there are different technologies that have sought, across government systems to regulate, it's been helpful. And so I'm hoping that there'll be regulations that help work towards making sure that AI is a safe tool and as much as possible and not used for hacking and fraud and, impersonating others, and can respect the intellectual property of individuals and things like that. So I am an optimist in general. So I think it is a tool that has a lot of promise, and as it continues to be integrated with things that we do, it will make some really helpful additions to what we're able to do, and things that we're able to use it for will help us have some really interesting advances. So yeah, I think on the whole, I'm optimistic. I just think that there do need to be some guardrails, so to speak, or things in place, because even as it's getting started now, you can almost see how there could be a greater disparity with it depending on a person's resources. So yeah. Are there any other thoughts or questions that you would like to address before we close our episode?
No, it's been such an interesting topic to look into, and I had a great time today for sure.
Thanks, Barney. Me too. Really appreciate you being willing to explore this topic with me. And also thank you to our listeners and viewers for coming along with us in this conversation. If you have any thoughts about AI that you would like to share with us, please feel free to include them in comments and responses to our podcast. And thank you for joining in for this time. We really appreciate it. And until next time.